This is tape five, side one, Dr. Edward Bowles interview, 7/15/87. You were referring to a trip to the Galapagos.
I go to the technical sergeant who's supposed to be in charge of repairs and all that kind of thing. Ask him about his problems. This is done in Talara, Peru. All he had was a screwdriver and an ohmmeter, that long end of the line. All he had to repair the equipment. I'm talking about radar now. I go back to Washington, go to see the chief signal officer, a new one now, not the one I met when I went down the first time. I told him about this fellow. Oh, he said, Professor Bowles, just a minute. He buzzed, and in comes a colonel with a great big binder. Oh, now, this is the equipment they have. The oscillograph, God knows what else. What he was telling me was what they're supposed to send out from the Kentucky warehouse, wherever they stored the. On its way down, I began to see that on the way, a person like the oscillograph, the first thing you know, it gets pushed aside. And by the time it got down there, there was nothing left but a screwdriver and an ohmmeter. He didn't like it much, but the point being that it's like all other human problems, it's one thing to go through the motions, it's another thing to get the end result. And that was one of the advantages of going to the front, because that's where the problems were, not back in Washington. Now, coming back to try to get on the track for you, I had become interested in the economics of warfare. I got Bill Shockley to make a study of the B-29s and what it cost us to put a B-29 over Japan.
This was prepared after the Raymond Kolbaum Wells report.
Yes. And what it caused in the way of loss to the Japanese. Now, up to that point, with due respect for all the poor devils who were worrying about it, we simply had as a rule, we're going to beat the hell out of them. So more ammunition or more guns or more of this, that, and the other. There wasn't much care given to resources. It didn't occur that we might, or the enemy might, run out of the capability of waging war, if you go to the extreme. It turned out we were, I don't remember, costing the Japs 20 times as much as it cost us at that moment to put a B-29 over Tokyo. I'll have to go over the record here to get that accurately. But I became very much interested in this, what we might call the economics of warfare. Instead of just assuming you'd overwhelm the services with means, men and material are important. So that's one element that I wanted to see, get into not just the military study, but a coordinated central study. Now, Arnold's paper was prepared by Shockley. He was the one that made the study of training. Now, I have here, it's not seen the light of day. Bill Shockley made a study of Russian capabilities in military technology.
When was this? When? What year was this? Date, please.
My eyes are blurry, but...
This is...
Yes.
This is report dated 30 January 1936 by Dr. William B. Shockley, entitled Relative Technological Achievements in Weapon Characteristics in USSR and USA.
And this report was prepared at your request?
Yes. Bill was working for me, one of my aces.
And you directed his attention to this question, or did he bring it to you as an area of interest?
No, I thought it was a vital interest because I couldn't see that we were really doing anything about it. I do know that we sent a man to Russia to be not a coordinator, but to help them in the field of electronics, and it couldn't have been a weaker sister we sent over. I mean, the theory was don't help him. He wasn't sent over as a spy. And I was interested in getting down to getting down to what I would call analysis, these problems, just as we did on training the crews. Now, I don't mean to say that there was negligence, but under the pressure of war, things get to be happening in a hell of a hurry. And there's an opportunity behind scenes to pick out some of these segments and bring them together. And I was beginning to feel very strongly that it needed a coordinated effort of industry and the military. Now, that was the same spirit, in a way, that I went into going to AT&T on AT, American Telephone and Telegraph, on the Air Transport Command. Here we have an industry, why not use it? Now, the Signal Corps didn't like it one damn bit at the time, because it interfered with their prerogatives. And yet the Air Transport Command, the requirements of a transport organization was vastly different than the specific military problem in a given campaign.
Excuse me, Dr. Bowles, why did you direct this report to be a comparison of the US and USSR? After all, we were not then at war with the USSR. Why a comparison? Why not? After all, Shockley had done comparisons for Japan and Germany as well for you, but not in this particular report, which is surprising. Why?
I suppose you can argue I was visionary, and I certainly wasn't prophetic. But as far as the technology was concerned, to me it seemed clear that the Russians were dangerously near us in capacity. And the worst mistake we could make is underestimate them. And why not think about it? What's gone through my mind since, when I look at the present administration, all we do is attack Russia. We never think of the possibility of having to get along with them. I'm saying that as an extreme, because that's the Reagan's point of view. He can't make a speech without making a crack at the Russians. They can't be as bad as all that. We may have to learn the Russian language someday. Now, in effect, there was the same problem with respect to Germany. But it happens that we, with a way we are, German, in a sense, is almost a common language in this country, if you need it. Russia is a thing we just neglected. It's worse than Greek, let me say. In other words, it isn't currency. Germany, many of our people speak German. If they don't, they're barely lit schools and so on. But we don't take to the Russian language. It's tough, difficult in many ways. And these people seem remotely different when back the citizenry is not really. They're like us, they're human. I don't know that that's a good argument at all, but I was interested in trying to get numbers into some of these things. Economy, economics. And some of these things, if they aren't dug up and examined, can be troublesome. During the submarine, anti-submarine campaign, you didn't hear anything about merchant ship crews. One of our greatest dangers was running out of merchant marine crews, not just ships. Every time a ship sank, it was an organized entity that went down with it. And we tend, I guess it's a human tendency to be optimistic or blind. And that was true in studying the, making that study of the B-29s. I don't think the analysis is earth-shaking in a way, but it, from a war standpoint, it was pretty important in the B-29 operation. Because not only was the 3/15th wing demonstrated as truly successful compared with the preceding version of the B-29, but the 3/16th wing was in process when the Japs surrendered.
Were there other people who were considering the economic ramifications of operations?
You've asked a mean question. The one man that saw eye to eye with me was a great scientist in Britain, an Irishman, Patrick Blackett, B-L-A-C-K-E-T-T. He was very active over there in, I won't say doing the same thing I was trying to do, but trying to get analysis into the problem, take the benefit of our resources, our, call it our getting numbers into things instead of ideas. I mean, when I say numbers, analysis, whatever that word may mean, he was interested in very much the same sort of thing. We got our heads together one time and over here, and I later went over there and spent some time with him. A brilliant man. He didn't have to advertise himself. During the war, he was a very quiet worker behind scenes, but an immense factor over there. He later got a Nobel Prize for all his scientific work. He was a nuclear physicist, strictly speaking. But the idea of getting things expressed in some kind of numbers, that was Shockley's talent. Shockley never made an estimate without estimating the percentage of error. Now that work Shockley did on the cost of the B-29s, what have we done?
I think she's indicating that lunchtime is upon us. Why don't you just finish your thought about Shockley and then we'll proceed to lunch.
this sounds like vanity, I guess, but, or ego. Blackett spent some time with me reviewing on this office of mine, if I may use those possessive terms, was doing. He took a dim view of Bush's operations. Now that doesn't help us too much, but Bush was a clever soul. But if one digs into some of these developments, his effect wasn't very substantial. He did pull together a lot of the technological workers in this country, some of whom were scientists. But what one must do is to look at the new weapons office in the Army.
Maybe we should save that for after long.
And Bush failed at every point. Now, this is getting off the subject, but to me it's important. Bush was not trusted. And you can't get away with the military without getting into their conscience and have them feel you're one of them.
You made that point yesterday too.
I hate to hide behind the word psychological, but I what little success I've had, some of my failures, goes back to my life in the country with lower animals. Now,
it's just when you describe Bush that way, it's so
extremely humorous.
Now,
we should put it on pause. I don't think
we are resuming our discussion about the origins of the RAND Corporation after a brief break for lunch. When we concluded just before lunchtime, we had talked about the B-29 project, and the beginnings of Arnold's interest in this.
Yes.
If we could pick up from that point and discuss the evolution of the concept.
Janet, I believe we sent a note to Wilkinson, was it a week ago or more? I believe I told him, maybe you have a copy of the letter, I believe I told him that you people were coming, I'm not sure. So he was forewarned. I told him about the colonel having been here. So he knows that much. And I believe I expressed the hope that we'd have this material in his hands before the year ends. Because last year, when he came up, he spent a whole day on this material. And as I interpret him, he was anxious to get it down there before the first of this year. And as far as I was concerned, it turned out just not to be feasible. So he knows, maybe through a couple of letters, that it couldn't be done. That is, we could not get it in his hands before the first of 87? But I did tell him in this last note we'd expect to get it to him before the end of the year. I don't know the argument, the reasons for it, but I think he seemed to have some pride in being able to make a public statement. I don't know what kind of minutes they publish on this, but for those who are interested in antique material, I think they want to make the announcement as the custodians. That sounds like, I don't know what, but ego. And I want to assure you that I've not been holding it because of any great pride. I'm just sort of slow at doing things now. And I'm, of course, delighted that Janet has been such immense help to me on this whole business, because without her inventory of it in her own mind, it would be kind of difficult for all of you right now. And it'll be more difficult if it's chucked into the Library of Congress right now. And I won't say given to the wolves, but if one has no concept of what is there in a broad way, it's going to take some time.
I'm sure you must realize that, for example, Vannevar Bush's papers are at the Library of Congress.
Well, wait a minute. Do we have the copy of the library from the Library of Congress on this? Way back when?
Upstairs, we noticed a report which you wrote for General Arnold. I believe I have. The past predicts the future.
Yes.
A speech before the International Institute of Aeronautical Sciences, in July of 1946. You volunteered to write this speech, as the letter upstairs indicates, for General Arnold. And I would like to know why you volunteered to write this speech. The speech, as you noted, became a major instrument articulation of Air Force policy, especially with respect to research and development. Did you know that this was an opportunity to produce that kind of policy?
It didn't occur to me. The answer is, like other answers, rather oblique. By this time, when the old man retired, I had an intense admiration for him. Now, I may sound like North and the president, but I had really worked with him, and it wasn't the nature of a man employed to do anything for him. For some reason, there was an empathy, or what one may call it. And I knew his difficulty, because the speeches that were written for him were atrocious. Now, that's a mean thing to say, but the Air Force boys would plug away sincerely. But it isn't that they were scared of the old man, but they were. Because at a moment's notice, they were done. And I didn't know of anyone, I would put it this selfishly, I wouldn't trust. I knew his difficulty, he wouldn't write it. So I made a choice of, do I help him or offer a volunteer to help him? Now, bear in mind, he was out there at his ranch in Sonoma Valley. He was interested enough in it for me to work on it. I I had excellent editorial help because my writing is not good. I go in, get into detail. And I thought it was a pretty well-constructed job because of the help that was given me. I was all through my period down there. I had the help of a very able rascal. Not to use the word rascal with affection. He breezed in from nowhere and just one of these enormously bright creatures, and he loved history and he enjoyed writing, and whenever I wanted to do something, I had I felt confident that if I had him look it over, he would help me in the mental in the organization of it. He was just bright. And I feared Arnold turning it over to arbitrarily to the Air Force to write. Now, that is the best statement I can make to you.
Who was this person who would help you?
I beg your pardon?
Who was the gentleman who would help you?
Rudolf Winokur. He helped for several, long after I left Washington, he helped the Secretary of War, subsequent to Stimson. He was in a back room in the Pentagon, and they kept him on as a consultant. And I beg your pardon?
Do you know how to spell his last name?
It's Rudolf Winokur, W-I-N-N-A-C-K-E-R.
Thank you.
Now, his wife is still alive. He died of leukemia about 2 years ago. He became an intimate friend. I first met him when he came in to see me about the submarine problem. At that time, he was a man on the sidelines, essentially a cultivated historian, as I see him. Not being a historian, I feel competent to make a judgment. But he had a great sense of what was going on within the War Department, or within the secretarial level of offices, for instance. And from the first day we met on the submarine problem, why, he was there to help me if I wanted advice on anything. And as a kind of a professional editor, excellent. And on some of this stuff, I was hard-pressed, in a way, trying to do a job. And I worried a great deal about any paper that got loose. I wanted to have it in decent shape. Therefore, I wanted editorial criticism on most everything I wrote. Now, that came to a sharp focus when I was called down there after the war to work with a couple of historians on the Signal Corps business. And they opened up a folder with, I don't remember, a lot of memorandums that I had written during the war. And I looked at them, and I was damn glad I had put time in preparing them. They were fairly well done pieces of paper. In other words, I didn't regret the care I took in trying to get that material together. Now, Alan Hazeltine wrote this, you can call it a diary, right here. He was very careful, and I wouldn't have this if he hadn't volunteered to write it. I have no authorship in this whatsoever. Now, I want to as long as this has come to the surface, I want to say that Alan did his job, not as a secretary to do much thinking, but as a secretary to scrupulously keep a record of what I was doing. Now, I qualify that. He never sat in on anything like my sessions with Arnold. Nor the only exception where he sat in on anything was at the beginning when the submarine question came up and I had to give a talk to Harry Hopkins in Mr. Stimson's office. That was the closest we got to the president on the submarine problem, by the way. And he kept, he got the charts together for me and presented the material, and it was based on that report on anti-submarine warfare, which was seminal to the whole business. This is a word of self-praise. I don't know where one will find a report like that on the anti-submarine situation. I say that bragging, but most of the stuff was buried in individual reports like the sinkings, things of that sort. Nobody sat down and collated the stuff, insofar as I'm aware. And in that report, I was trying to not to criticize, but to point out weaknesses, for instance, on the lack of air coverage and the argument for four-engine bombers. Granted, by that time, even in those early days, I knew pretty well Arnold's view. I thought I did. And all the way through my experience down there, I kept the old rascal in mind, and I won't say I try to do his thinking for him, but I try to polish off the edges. And so in this, or the thoroughgoing report, it's solely Alan Hazeltine's version. Nobody collaborated on this at all, unless it might be some of the girls in the outer office, and there were five, as I remember it, at that time, by that time. As I say, when Arnold caught me in the hall and wanted me to come to his office, I think one of the reasons we did pretty well, there was nobody in there but the two of us. It wasn't one of these semi-committee affairs where he called in a lot of others. He didn't work that way. His habit was to call a man in, whether he wanted to fire him or whether he didn't. There was none of this business of group activity on his part. For instance, Hazeltine wouldn't know about this, and I wouldn't expect him to have to know. I made a condition with General Arnold, and that sounds terrible, but I got away with it. I asked him to relieve the general officer in charge of Air Force communication. I'm sorry. I asked him to rescind the orders he had given on General McClellan, who was the top man in the Air Force on radio or electronics. Now, he had already, as I've told you this morning, made a complaint out loud to Marshall and McNarney. They had suggested me coming into the picture. I can't debate that, but it came from, the information came later from McNarney. If he wanted the communications business straightened out, I didn't see how I could go in there with the man in charge in whom I had no confidence, McClelland. He had ordered McClelland down to Florida, the famous Yeah, that's right. Now, my feeling, a matter of judgment, good or bad, my feeling was I couldn't step in the capacity that was outlined in that directive, copies of which you may have seen. And have the boys in the Air Corps, whether I agreed with them or not, collaborate with me when I took charge, in effect. This is a kind of a nebulous position in that I was given all sorts of authority as a half-baked individual. I was part Secretary of War. Ultimately, if the directive was acted on, I was supposed to supervise, in effect, Air Force problems, everything but pigeons, and I guess I included them. Now, I made a condition in this letter to Arnold, which is in the files somewhere, that I would ask him to rescind the orders on McClelland, who was the top officer in communications, feeling that I could not take that group of people over without support of the people below, McClelland included. And the old rascal acceded. I think it's a historical. Damned if he didn't rescind the orders on McClelland. I made that as a condition, and it was a test as to whether I was going to be able to do the job. And that was one of them. The other one was that I picked my own officers, which I did from right field. There weren't any officers, much. There were only three officers running around at headquarters I could get my fingers on. I had met all those in connection with NDRC work before I ever went down to Washington. And I like to believe I defended, they respected me before this happened. And McClelland was, I would describe as a typical officer of the, I'd put down the ladder, many rungs. He felt that he was only a major general, and if only Arnold had had sense, he would have made him a major general, and then he could do his job. I mean, it was that kind of an attitude of the man. Anyway, we got him deposed and then brought back. Or Arnold deposed him and then brought him back. Now, Arnold would depose people. There'd be no, he wouldn't waste any time. If he didn't feel a man performed, the man was out. Whether one likes that way of operating or not is another story, but that was Arnold's method. I go back, and I've said repeatedly, I owed it a debt to old Jackson at MIT because he was a, could be a cussed soul, but firm. So I was prepared for Arnold's method of attack. So this lacks flavor in those respects that have to do with my personal exposure to people in the Air Force right straight through, including Arnold.
Just for the record here, again, you're referring to the Hazeltine history.
That doesn't mean that this is not an effective document. It's simply that my thinking I didn't have a staff in the office. I didn't get people together and give them a lecture on what I was doing. Because so much of it was done by the grace of God, so to speak. We had no great conferences. For instance, at the end of the war, that is it, when the negotiations began to take place, I spent a month with Eisenhower's command, Beadle Smith, who was Eisenhower's right-hand man. And I think the one man who did most of the thinking for him. He wanted to use technical intelligence, which was the military term, more broadly than it was specified in the usual directives. Technical intelligence was supposed to be that intelligence that had to do with making better guns, better ammunition, and other things of that sort relating to the military. Beadle Smith wanted it to be broad enough to include what some bozo wrote into Eisenhower's speech later, the military-industrial complex. He wanted the investigations over there to be broad enough, measured in terms of the value to the industry as well as to the specific military fields like ordnance and ballistics and what have you. And so behind scenes, I wrote a proposed directive on that for Beadle Smith, acting for Beadle Smith for Eisenhower. There's not a thing on that in here. I can't remember, it's an acronym, and there's a binder upstairs in one of those, I think in one of the boxes, I'm not sure, covering that work. It was a kind of a sandwiched in element, and Hazeltine had no reason for knowing about that at all.
Well, I think that describes the basic characteristics of this document.
Yeah.
I think it would be useful now to move on to the RAND question once again.
I've never edited it in that sense at all. I haven't touched it.
Okay, well, that's good historical background to have on the
Absolutely.
Document.
It's good. He was very able. But I never sat down with him and discussed my interests, my leanings, my feelings, or the military personalities.
Okay. Well, let's move on then, how you began to formulate the RAND concept and began to work that out. Before you launch into your answer, since we're at the end of the tape here, let me go ahead and turn this over. Okay.